The Myriad travelled a great deal, as I said, or at least a great deal compared to me. She ranged far just on her own, but she also accompanied the reindeer hunters on their travels. The band that visited me was one of many that travelled the northern lands, nearly all of them related to each other in some way. The Myriad told me that they would meet up every few years in summer at a campground to the east and a little south of where I sat, where a river flowed out of a lake. They would greet old friends, exchange gifts. Maybe when the gathering broke up, some would leave the groups they'd travelled with before and join new ones to be with a friend or a lover, or just for a change. This was the time and place one would be most likely to find things that would usually be rare or scarce. At first, these would be things like particularly well-wrought stone blades or ivory or antlers carved into shapes. Fish, birds and humans were all popular, sometimes simply because they were appealing, but sometimes because they were an emblem associated with a god that was a particular favourite or who might appreciate the flattery. The people who visited me often carried small flat stones, each with a stylized image etched into it. With a hole drilled into them or notched on two sides, they could be tied to a strip of leather, hung around the neck, or attached to a coat or a shirt. These became quite popular at the large meetings, and the Myriad was quite pleased with how often they were decorated with mosquitoes. She also pointed out the ones that bore a pair of concentric circles. These were meant to indicate me, she told me, though they were popular mostly with our own regular visitors. I did not travel, as she did. Over the decades, things changed. The people began to cook with carved stone pots instead of tightly woven sedge and heated stones. Their language changed. A slow smattering of new words, the loss of others, sounds picked up or dropped. And eventually, words taken from what the Myriad told me were other, entirely different languages, from the south. I had only ever spoken the one language, and I was accustomed to think of that language as something naturally occurring, something part of the fundamental nature of the world. Firstly, because it was the only language I knew of, and secondly, because I could use that language to make things happen. But I was also used to the slow change of everything around me. It seemed completely natural that language would do the same. I'd half expected it from the start. The sudden revelation that other, very different languages existed, that shocked me. The Myriad was surprised at my surprise. It hadn't occurred to her that when she reported on the far-flung people she visited and mentioned words she'd learned, I would take those words only in the context of the language we were speaking to each other, and not intuit the existence of the languages from which those words had come. She thought it was funny when she realized. And because she'd learned of the existence of those other very different languages much earlier than I had, she had never apparently thought of our first language in the same way I had. When I asked her if she could make things happen by speaking in one of those other languages, she flew tight, puzzled circles around me for 5 minutes, and then said that yes, of course she could. Did I really think it was the sound of the words that did the work? She didn't see how I could think that, because for one thing, the pronunciation of the words we used had changed quite a lot since we'd first learned language, and for another, if it were just the sound, why, human beings ought to be able to make things happen just by speaking in the same way that gods did, and for another. I often spoke to the reindeer hunters using the wooden tokens, which did not convey meaning with sound at all. I admitted that I had never used communication by token to fulfill a petition. I hadn't realized that might be possible. And then I pointed out that, in fact, there were many things human beings could make happen just by speaking. Granted, I had never seen one say something like, "For the next minute I will hover a foot off the ground," with any actual result in that direction, where I myself had done exactly that once, after very careful consideration of whether I had enough power to make that happen without injuring myself. What can I say? I was curious, and also easily amused. But I hadn't thought my ability to affect the world with speech to be different in kind from what humans could do, only different in scope. And the changing of pronunciation, and in some cases of grammar, hadn't troubled me. I knew things changed slowly, and so the right way to say words would also change. It was not essential, I thought, to use one particular set of words or way to say them, but rather to use the words that were right in that particular moment in those particular circumstances. That struck her as almost, but not quite, right. And we would have discussed longer and in more detail, except for the fact that gods have to be very careful when speaking about the nature of things. It might be that if you're strong enough, you can perhaps risk saying something like, "The world is round like a berry and moves around the sun, which is much, much larger than it looks in the sky," without knowing beforehand if it's true. Maybe. What if you're wrong? What god is strong enough to endure the loss of the sort of power that even begins to touch what it would take to make that true, to change the very nature of the entire universe? It might or might not be a riskier statement than one on the nature of language. So everything we said to each other had to be couched in qualifiers. It might be, I suppose, it's likely that, or else in statements that we already knew to be factual. We didn't get very far in our conclusions. I spent a lot of time thinking about it, though, when I was alone. I thought of what the myriad had said about those other languages. I wondered what would happen if I were to say a thing in one of those languages that I did not understand. Would it make whatever those words meant true, even if I did not understand what it was I had said? And what about the tokens, which did not make any sound at all, besides perhaps a faint clicking and rattling in their box or bag? How did words mean things to begin with? I thought also of those gods I'd seen in the time before humans had existed, who could not have possibly spoken a human language and yet wielded great power. Could it be that language was not the source of the power, but one possible tool for using that power? Those other, older gods must have known of a different one. I wondered what it was and how they had learned of it, and why language worked the way it did for me in the myriad, but not, as I'd mistakenly thought, for the humans who visited me. Somewhat obviously, the answer to that second question is, humans are not gods, unless they are inhabited by a god, which is, of course, a special case. But that doesn't get to the deeper question. What is it that makes language a far more powerful and risky tool for gods than it is for even humans? What is it that makes gods gods? What am I? I beg your forgiveness. I have long been in the habit of musing to myself in the chilly silence of my northern hillside. It is still easy for me to be distracted by such thoughts. I will resume explaining my history. As had happened occasionally over the years, the far north grew colder, too cold for the reindeer hunters to visit me. And so I sat alone for some centuries, not visited even by the myriad. I knew I was not forgotten. Occasionally, perhaps every few years, I felt the satisfying small influx of a prayer or offering, usually, though not always, accompanied by the tug of a petition. Sometimes I had a sense of what the petition was, at least in general terms, but mostly it was just a feeling. Along with watching the snow, watching the geese stream overhead spring after spring, watching the stars and their slow, satisfying movement around the sky, I would sometimes ponder whether I could or should grant these indefinite-to-me petitions. Some of the offerings even seemed to come with a catch. The reindeer hunters had done that occasionally in my presence, and I knew the feeling of it, the tiny power the prayer might afford me, hanging, waiting for me to provide what had been asked for, thus fulfilling the condition for me to accept the offering. Still, it was my choice. It might be as simple as saying, "Let this petitioner have what they ask for," which could be quite risky. What if the petitioner had asked for my destruction, or, unknowing, asked for something that would injure themselves or a great many other people? Was the offering enough to take such a risk? Could any offering be enough for that? I had no way to know, and so I did not fulfill any of the requests that were made during that time. Here is a story that I have heard. There was once a god who generally used the form of a snow goose, and this god favoured a particular human to the point of making her an extravagant gift. God-spoken objects are exceedingly rare in Iriden. I dare say you could count them on the fingers of one hand if you were made aware of them. They are less rare outside Iriden. I think you have seen the Tell bring them into battle against Iridenni forces, but even so, I doubt they are particularly common anywhere in the world. Either few gods are foolhardy enough to make them, or powerful enough to afford the risk, or else most of the gods who have taken the risk have not survived it long. In this case, the god-spoken object was a spearhead of napped obsidian. Once each day, any creature at which this particular person aimed and cast the spearhead would die. The danger of speaking this way about an object lies in the likelihood of its being used in an unintended way, one that would end up costing far more power than the god possessed. This is one reason gods so often speak very precisely. After all, it seems a simple thing to say, for example, "I will cross the river." Humans cross rivers, large and small, quite routinely, with little or no godly assistance. How much, then, could it cost a god to fulfil that statement? But there are so many ways that statement might be made true. Yes, one might simply walk across a bridge, or take a ferry, or wade across a ford, but one might also fly across that river. And if one is not a bird or in some other form that facilitates flying, that flight might well come at great cost. Or one might simply be on one bank, and then suddenly gone, to appear on the other. I think this has only succeeded in very particular circumstances. For instance, I imagine the myriad might move very quickly among her many mosquito bodies, and the stone in which she fell from the sky. But in most other cases, I suspect that such travel is an actual impossibility. Or at the very least, I fear it is too costly for any god I know of. At any rate, my point is that when one says a thing like, "I will cross the river," one leaves open the question of how and when one's words will be made true. And the how and when are important. But this gift of a god-spoken spear point in this story that I heard must have seemed safe enough for the goose god. After all, the hunter must actually aim and cast the thing so that the spear would already be moving more or less in its intended direction. To make that flight fatal to its target should be a small enough thing, a nudge here or there to make it fly true, with sufficient force to kill. And it could be used this way only once a day, and only by a specifically named person. These are all prudent limits on the use of such an object. The owner of the spear point died, and her heirs left the spear point at her grave. But long years later, it was found again by someone who knew only that he had found a good spear point at a time of great need. Returning home, he gave this spear point to his son, who, whether by chance or by a long and twisting chain of connected circumstance, had the same name as the point's original owner. Long years might have passed, and the spear point and its owner might have been largely forgotten, apparently along with the knowledge of how graves were marked in former times. But the goose god still thrived, and it was the goose god who first recognized the spear point and realized the potential danger of the situation. He had assumed that his obligation had passed when the point's first owner had died. He had assumed that the first owner's name was sufficiently distinctive that it would not be held by some other person in the future. Those assumptions had been unfounded. For now, the danger was slight, but no doubt the goose god could imagine the potential for future disaster. This new holder had not yet realized what he had. He thought only that it was a particularly lucky point. It might, then, be best to convince him to hand it over to the goose god, and then find some way to hide it so that it would never accidentally come to light again. And in the meantime, the goose god would think of some way to safely dispose of it. Accordingly, the god approached the point's new owner and asked for it as a gift. Now, this man's family was under an obligation to the goose god, and he felt that he could not refuse the god's request, but it seemed particularly hard to give up the best weapon the man owned, the one that seemed always to bring down its target neatly and surely, at least once in a day. He was, in fact, about to head out to hunt when the goose god approached him, and so, with ill grace, he tossed the weapon to the god. Eventually, the cold receded, and people returned to me. Reindeer hunters and herders, who set up their tents in the marshy field between my hillside and the river. But they spoke a different language, and called themselves by a different name, the Kalawet. The people I had known had eaten primarily reindeer and fish, with the occasional goose. But these people would not harm geese, let alone eat them. It was from these people that I heard the story of the goose god and his struggle with the power that had condemned him to destruction. His own power. These new people carried lamps of clay instead of the stone ones I had seen before, and some of them carried metal knives. During the time I'd been alone, the every few years camp by the lake had become a small, permanent settlement. People whose travels ordinarily took them to the east or the south brought things they'd found or traded for, and sometimes new people. These people were themselves related to people farther east and farther south until the lake camp became one of several centres in a web of relationships that stretched across the north, east to the mountains, and south to Shoulder Sea. The flow of new people and things into the camp, and thus to the bands of people travelling the north, was constant, if slow. Pottery had been one of those new things, and eventually fine-spun and dyed wool, glass beads, and metalwork made their way north. These things had been familiar to the Kalawet for decades, but it was all still new to me then. Despite their new language, these people knew the myriad by her old name. She arrived along with them and flew straight over to greet me. And they knew my name. "They haven't forgotten you," she told me. "I hear that you saved the child from drowning, and I'm told you saved the family from starvation when they prayed to you and then found the cache of dried fish that had not been there when last they'd looked." "I didn't," I replied. "I think some people asked me for things, but I didn't grant any of it. I couldn't be sure what it was I'd be saying yes to." "You're probably wise," said the myriad. "And yet, how much more famous and powerful might you be if you had actually helped everyone who called on you this long while?" "I don't need to be famous and powerful," I replied. "Do you not?" asked the myriad. "Well, it's troublesome to be frequently called on, it's true, but for the most part, I enjoy it." I believe she did. And I believed she loved to travel, to meet humans and gods, and loved it when everyone she knew was associated, tied together, trading, travelling. It was partly because of this that the Kalawet carried so much wood. You grew up on the edge of a great forest, and perhaps think nothing of being surrounded by trees, of making and using all sorts of wooden objects, of picking up a few twigs off the ground, with no doubt a cautious prayer to the forest, and building a fire. So easy, so simple. But trees won't grow where it's too cold. Oh, some trees will tolerate ice and snow better than others, but in the very far north, where only the thin top layer of soil thaws in the summer, the only trees are the occasional stunted willow, more a shrub than a tree, that one might find by a stream. Still, wood is useful and necessary for so much. The reindeer hunters I had known before had used wood, nearly all of it driftwood, sticks and even whole trees and boards from broken-up boats. All of it had floated on the sea, sometimes for years before washing onto some northern shore. This was hardly a steady supply, but wood was so necessary and valuable that even I, well inland, had received the occasional petition to ensure a good haul of high-quality driftwood in the coming year. So far as I knew, no northern god could fulfill such petitions. But a southern god might. It turned out that the trees that reached us far in the north had grown in southern forests, beside southern rivers. By some chance they had fallen into the water and drifted to the sea, and if the right current took them, they would arrive, eventually, in the north. How to make this happen regularly, reliably? It took long years of investigation. Where were those trees coming from? What forests, what rivers, which currents? What circumstances brought a tree from Ardvustia to the icy northern sea? And once those questions had been answered, negotiation. What humans and gods could affect those circumstances? What would they want in exchange for doing so? The Myriad was not the only northern god involved in the project, but involved she was. It was she who had first asked those questions and plotted a way to find answers. While I sat thinking for centuries, she spread out to the south, inquiring, suggesting meetings, convincing gods to come together and make joint agreements for the sake of providing a steady flow of wood to the far north. In the end, agreements were made between two groups of gods, most of the major northern gods on one hand, and on the other, a coalition of gods located in and around the northern shore of the Shoulder Sea. A predetermined number of trees would be felled and deliberately set afloat. The gods of the south would be sure they made their way to the north. In return, the gods of the north would send south not only a share of the offerings of various northern peoples, including the Kalawet and their seagoing cousins and neighbours who subsisted on seals and whales, but also loads of sealskins and obsidian. "I suspect we have more treasure under the ice," the Myriad told me. "I have been thinking about what sorts of rocks are found where, and I wonder what we might find if we could only delve deeply enough in the right places." But she was pleased with the deal she and others had struck. "It has been somewhat difficult for me to reach you until lately. I did obtain an agreement that you would be able to join the Northern Coalition if you wished, and if you made the same promises as the rest of us." "That was good of you," I replied. I had not needed to ponder the offer for more than an hour or two, but I believe my current circumstances to be sufficient for the moment.
"They may be, if all you wish for is to be a large stone on a hillside," the Myriad said. "Don't you want to travel? Wouldn't you like to see new things? I believe you like to think about things and ask yourself questions and ponder the answers. Moving about, meeting others, is a way to learn things that might answer those questions and enrich your pondering. In short, you may find you enjoy it as much as you do staring at the sky. Perhaps even more than that?
Perhaps, I said, but I'm not eager to make any long-term commitments, and moving myself does take quite a lot of power.
Granted that stone is heavy and difficult to move, agreed the myriad. You could always leave it for a more portable sort of body, and it might even be one that would make it easier for you to speak in a way that humans can hear and understand.
I'm comfortable as I am, I said. I don't really like the idea of not being a stone, and I'm not sure how I would make it happen if I did want to.
It's fairly simple, the myriad told me, though I admit it can be disorienting the first time.
And I don't believe it's much of a hardship to speak to humans as I am. In fact, there are some advantages to doing it the way I do. For instance, these people who are camped in the valley now, even if I spoke in a voice they could hear, which I could, with some effort, they would not understand me. I don't speak their language, but one of them is carrying a full set of tokens, and she seems to know how to interpret them.
But do you understand her when she speaks?
Asked the myriad. When she uses the tokens to communicate with me? Yes. When she speaks aloud, a little. These new people had been camped below me for a week or so, at this point in the conversation. A different body wouldn't necessarily help me with that.
But travel would, the myriad pointed out. Their language is quite familiar to me because I haven't been apart from them all this time.
There doesn't seem to be any need for hurry, I replied.
There never does to you, the myriad agreed amiably. Hurry is not a word I associate with you at all.
In this case, I may listen to them or not, as I wish. I do quite well on my own, which brings me to my second point. The myriad waited, and then, as she was relatively impatient,
that being?
I'm not sure it's wise to entangle myself with any promises regarding complicated situations. It's one thing to grant a simple request, land a fish, start a fire, cure a sickness or an injury or two. Yes, I've done those things, nearly always in exchange for an offering. Sometimes I've been asked, but have chosen not to do the thing I'm asked to do. I can do that with no risk, because I have made no commitments, no promises. The story about the spear point and the goose? Was that something that actually happened?
I don't know, admitted the myriad. There are many implausibilities in the story as I heard it, but I knew the god in the story, and I've not seen or heard from him for long centuries. I suspect something like it happened, but I don't think it is likely to be accurate in all its details.
A complicated promise, I said, is a risky one. So many parts, so many people involved, and you don't always know who all the people are or will be. And gods, too. And the world does not stay the same. Things change. Slowly. It may be too slowly to perceive at the time, but things change all the same.
True enough, replied the myriad. Well, do you wish to join the coalition of northern gods?
I am still thinking about that.
I have never known you to be hasty, said the myriad. I believe all of us know enough of you to realize you won't decide anything without time and thought.
But I never did join. I was glad of the steady flow of wood, certainly, but my joining or not had no effect on that. I believe I missed out on some benefits. I seem to recall that the gods involved in the agreement were entitled to a larger share of the wood, and apportioned it among their favoured worshippers. But it was rare for any human in that time and place to worship one god exclusively, and I never knew any of my own worshippers who did not also make offerings to far more prominent and powerful gods, most of whom were part of that coalition. Still, it was that agreement over driftwood and that coalition that drew me into Ardvulthir's war against the Raven of Iriden. That evening, you returned to Moat's room and stood a moment, considering. That morning's tray with a bowl of congealed porridge was gone, and no other seemed to have taken its place. The corridor was empty, but for you. You knocked. "My lord," you said, in a conversational tone, as though Moat was standing beside you, or perhaps immediately on the other side of the door, ear pressed to the wood. "My lord, it's time to come out. I need to talk to you." Still silence. Then the door opened, and Mawat took hold of your arm, drew you into the room, and closed the door behind you. The room was low-ceilinged and dimly lit. The windows across the far wall were shuttered, only one partly open to shed some light without exposing the room to view. A high-backed chair with embroidered cushions, red and blue and yellow, sat facing the door, and beside it sat a small wooden table inlaid with ivory and gold. Woolen hangings covered the unwindowed walls, white and black, and shot with gold thread that shone dully in the low light. A wooden bench alongside one of the hangings held the tray with the now empty bowl of porridge, along with two or three other trays you hadn't seen before. But I imagine you had suspected their existence, or at any rate, you evinced no surprise at seeing them. "Where have you been?" Moat asked you. "I've been waiting for you to come back." "My lord," you acknowledged with a slight bow of your head, "I was talking to people, looking around." "My father never fled," said Moat, not vehemently or angrily, just matter-of-factly.
"No, my lord," you agreed. "He can't have gone out the gate. I can't imagine any bribe that would keep the gate guard silent all this time, with not even a whisper. And there are guards at the tower door, besides."
"He couldn't have gone out of the tower," agreed Moat. "Not without the tower servants knowing about it. And none of them would have helped him flee. The Raven's favour is granted in exchange for the lease's life. To default on that debt..." Moat turned, strode to the shuttered windows and back. "He never would." His voice was tight and vehement. "My father was no coward." You looked at Moat a moment, and then said, "My lord," and nothing more. Moat frowned.
"I know that tone. Out with it."
"The Lady Tikaz told me the seaside of the fortress's watch, but..."
"Tikaz told you?"
Moat laughed.
"And when were you conversing with Tikaz?"
"I met her in the fortress yard earlier, my lord."
"Well, this is something."
Moat was grinning.
"So quiet and patient. But when you see what you want, you move, don't you?"
He waved away any potential protest or denial.
"Well, you have as much of a chance with her as anyone. Better than I ever did with her, Raven knows. I wish you luck. I won't warn you to be careful of her. You'll already have seen that she can take care of herself. But you were saying..."
You took a deep breath, and then said cautiously,
"My lord, might your father, the Lys, have gone into the sea?"
Moat stared at you for a full 5 seconds.
"Into the sea?"
It was not a question,
if there were a boat waiting, if the tide were high enough?
The tide is never that high,
said Moat angrily.
You don't know anything about tides.
No, my lord, you agreed.
My father never fled.
Moat's voice was angry now.
No, my lord,
you repeated.
I'm just trying to find out how things stand. What's possible? What might have happened?
And anyway, said Moat, voice conversational again, though he was clearly still on edge,
where would he have gotten a boat that no one saw, even though there are always ships and boats going back and forth in the strait?
My lord, your voice was apologetic, if I were charged with handling this situation,
I would likely not want any foreign ships to realise what had happened. And given that, I would perhaps not be able to ask very many people directly what they might or might not have seen. Even posing the questions indirectly hints at trouble in the fortress, and not every captain who sails through the strait is a friend of Iriden.
I dare say most of them aren't, conceded Moat.
And in any event, Hibal, I won't call him Lys. Raven take him.
You wince to hear that.
He doesn't deserve that name. That's my father's place and mine after.
Yes, my lord.
Hibal must know what really happened. He's always been meddlesome. He wanted to be heir to the Lys, but my father was chosen instead. He's always consulting with the directions, urging them to counsel the Lys to change some policy or other he was sure he knew better about. Always saying sideways things to let everyone know when he thought matters would have gone better if only the Lys had done as he'd suggested. And now, so conveniently, he's on the bench. Oh, Hibal knows what's happened to my father. Depend on it.
My lord, might he have helped the Lys to flee, so that he could take his place?
Moat took a step toward you.
My father never...
Yes, my lord,
you cut in.
Somewhat to my surprise, I never knew Moat to take that sort of thing well.
You yourself have told me that one doesn't win battles by planning for what one assumes or wishes to be true.
I don't need you to tell me what I said,
Moat snapped.
No, my lord,
you said shortly, and turned to go.
Wait,
cried Moat.
You stopped, but did not turn back.
Apparently, I do need to tell you what I said. But Aelo, my father never fled.
I'm sure not,
you agreed, still not turning around.
My father is dead,
said Moat.
I'm sure of it. It's the one certain thing, the one truth I can depend on in all of this. My father would never shirk the duty he had prepared for all his life, no matter the circumstances. Do you remember that tellboy, last year, opened his veins with what? The edge of a buckle? Badly enough to kill himself?
He had...
you began. Moat angrily cut your words short.
He must have had help. Yes, Stalker surely helped him. It was worth her while to do it. Do you think it would be less worth the Ravens to offer such opportunity to my father? Even with a god so distant, between instruments, it's a small thing to provide a sharp edge, a weapon in reach, anything. And do you imagine that, offered that help, my father would have failed to take it? He was loyal to the Raven. He was the Lys, and he knew his duty.
You said nothing. And after a moment, Moat continued, fierce and emphatic.
Will you tell me that some starved stripling managed to keep his word and sacrifice himself in the most unlikely circumstances, but my father, who had expected and prepared for this his whole life, would not? No. It's impossible. And Hibal could not sit on the bench if my father were still alive. My father is dead, and there is only one way the Raven's lease can die. He must sacrifice himself to the Raven. Anyone trying to kill him, it's happened, anyone trying to kill him ends up dead. It would take a god's power to kill the lease before his time, and even then, why do that, when his time was mere days away? Which means, no matter what Hibal did, my father has died for the Raven, as he was meant to do. It would never have let Hibal, of all people, stop him. No, this isn't about my father. It's about the bench. Hibal has always wanted my father's place. He has to be involved.
You frowned then, and turned around to face Moat. But how did he manage it, whatever it was he did? And why would your uncle be confirmed so quickly when you were nearly here?
It's risky, between instruments. Ordinarily, anyone can talk to the Raven, and he can speak to anyone he wishes, but when he doesn't have a body to inhabit, it's more complicated. Only a few people have the means to speak with him at such times, and his replies or advice can be difficult to decipher. He keeps commitments he's already made, of course, but if there were some new crisis that required his intervention, he might not help in time. And that's assuming we've kept our bargain with him and he was entirely well disposed toward us. And what if...
Mauat stopped and took a breath.
What if the council could be convinced that my father's supposed flight was planned somehow, and I was involved, or that I've inherited whatever weakness led my father to flee? Before long, the fact of the lease's absence will be obvious to everyone, and now is not a time to appear weak. Hibal will have had some such argument ready for the directions. Radihor will have swallowed it like milk with honey, and Hibal will have gone immediately to confer with Zhezume. No lease can take the bench without the approval of the Mother of the Silent. I couldn't be declared heir without her approval. But how could she have listened to him? I can hardly believe she would agree to this, and yet none of this could be happening without her assistance.
I don't understand, you said. I don't understand why the Raven hasn't said anything.
I know they said they asked. There will be a reckoning.
Moat quoted.
It's not exactly clear, is it? A reckoning for what?
That's what I don't understand. Why is it so difficult to talk to the Raven right now?
While the new instrument is in the egg, he doesn't have a mouth to talk with. So getting an answer when you need it is a little complicated. Still, I would like to ask him myself.
You said you had the right to do that.
I do.
Moat agreed.
If I'm the heir. And Hibal said I was still the heir.
He gave a bitter ha.
Still.
Then ask him.
The Raven surely knows what happened and what's happening. He's got to give you more of an answer. No, he doesn't. Hibal sat on the bench and still lives. The Raven said long ago that only the lease could do that. And what the Raven says is true, or his power makes it true.
So, Hibal is lease, you said.
Let him be lease. You're still heir. Let's go back and fight the Tell. Let Hibal die for the Raven. If anyone else had said that to me, said Moat coldly, he would be dead now. That place is mine. Hibal doesn't belong on that bench. What has he done to get there? And I'm to disgrace my father and prove myself useless and watch as Hibal enjoys the privileges of the lease.
You said nothing. After a moment, Mauat went over to the cushioned chair, sat heavily and put his face in his hands.
I won't let him profit from this,
he said after a while.
And Zhezume!
He looked up, tears in his eyes.
She might as well have been my own mother.
The woman who had given birth to Mowat had died doing it.
I'm sorry, my lord,
you said. He wiped his eyes then, shook his head.
But you.
How have you been keeping?
I threw you on your own resources. I'm sorry, but I couldn't trust myself even to speak these last 2 days. Has anyone in the hall given you trouble?
He waved you to sit on the bench next to the trays with their empty dishes. You sat.
Mother Jejume thought it unsuitable for me to stay in the hall. She gave me lodgings in the guest house right outside the gate.
Where the Julans are staying?
Yes, they have a snake with them. Doesn't look like any snake I've ever seen.
Oh, they've brought a god with them. How powerful a god, I wonder. Are they still trying to get permission to cross?
Yes.
You frowned.
They...
You hesitated.
They seem very interested in whether or not you were popular, or if a lot of people would be happy to find you on the bench.
Huh.
Mowat again, bitterly amused.
They made friends with Hibble, and now he's on the bench. They were expecting him to give them whatever they wished, but they've been disappointed. It's the Council of the Directions preventing him, I suppose. You can have whatever you want, Aslis. Take nearly anything. But if it has to do with what the laws are, or trade, or war, the Directions will have their say. Well, I wonder what I can make out of that. Has anyone else sought you out?
My lord, you said. The Lord Direction Dara is staying in the same guest house.
Mowat frowned.
Did he recognize you? From Owenda, I mean.
You hesitated.
I don't think so,
and shook your head.
I don't think he'd have any reason to. He just said someone told him I sounded like I was from his district.
Let me guess. He wanted to know if there was any way he could be of service to me.
You inclined your head, confirmation of his guess.
Dara and Radihor have never liked each other, and neither Dara nor his home territory of Owenda is wealthy enough to outweigh Radihor's authority. But of course, if he had the favour of the next lease...
He shook his head.
Watch yourself with that one. They're feeding you, I suppose.
You seemed unfazed by the sudden change of topic.
Yes, my lord.
Then go have supper. If anyone asks, I'm still too upset to speak about this. But don't be surprised at anything I do in the next day or two. And whatever you do, don't tell anyone about these suspicions, not even Tikas.
You can rely on me, my lord?
I know I can.
He said,
"Now, go."
The Raven of Iriden is not from Iriden. That would be a strange thing to say in that first language I learned to understand. In Irideni, there are two words, one for belonging to or being a part of, and one for coming from somewhere. It's not that the Kalouet and their cousins don't know the difference between those things, they assuredly do, but when they talk, they slide back and forth between those meanings, and for the most part, whoever they speak to understands without being told which meaning is intended. But perhaps the fact that the same word is used to speak these different things means that the ideas, belonging to, coming from, do blur together. Perhaps. And I've sometimes wondered if speakers of Irideni have noticed that belonging to and being a part of aren't necessarily the same thing. Sometimes they are, certainly, but not always. And I wonder if I notice that only because this language is so different from my first, and I have had such a long, uninterrupted time to consider it. In any event, it is as I've said. The raven of Iriden is not, in fact, of Iriden. Where exactly he came from, I don't know. Somewhere in the mountains to the south, I should imagine. He did not come from any part of the far north that I'm familiar with. But wherever he came from, I imagine it was some place that did not offer the wealth or power his ambition demanded. But wherever he came from, I imagine it was some place that did not offer the wealth or power his ambition demanded. Or perhaps something or someone made his former home less congenial to him, drove him out, pushed him farther north. Here is a story I have heard. The raven, having decided to settle in what would become Vastai, sent his people there with orders to build a house and a tower in which he might roost. And they, believing themselves protected by the powerful word of their god, arrived and set about building. The story says they began by taking axes to the largest trees in the nearby forest. Can you hear me? At the very least, I don't think you can understand me, or I'm certain you would have shivered when I said that, or even recoiled. The god of the silent forest has not spoken for decades, for at least a century. Indeed, that god may as well be dead. And some Iridenni have dared whisper the possibility one to another in secret, but never aloud. Almost no Iridenni quite dares to defy the god of the silent, and those foolhardy enough to do so are silenced at the first opportunity. Such is that god's hold on your people, even now. The influence of the god of the silent stretched for miles down the coast of the Shoulder Sea, almost to the mountains and well inland. At first it concerned itself only with what happened under and among its own trees. But the humans and smaller gods who eventually came to live in the forest's shadow could not afford to ignore the forest. First of all, as I'm sure you are already aware, humans use wood for cooking and heat, for buildings, for record-keeping, for storage, for boats, and more. And second, the boundary between inside the forest and outside it was, and is, always changing. What was safely outside might in future years be swallowed up, and people's attempts to prevent this, to define and maintain a boundary beyond which the forest would not grow, could and did elicit the wrath of the god of the silent. It was not a simple thing to come to an agreement with that god, one that would allow humans to live safely around its periphery, to gather necessary firewood, or cut the occasional tree. The god did not need any agreement after all. Its very size ensured that people who came across it would suspect its nature, and make offerings in the hope that the god would help them, or at least not harm them. And the god itself did very little that cost it much power. And so that god was strong with offerings without ever having to give much in return. The forest had no real reason to even respond to human petitions, let alone enter into a long conversation that might lead to future obligations on its part. But at long last, a mother of the silent convinced the god that, powerful as it was with so little effort on its part, it might be yet more powerful and hold its trees even more securely if it would only make a single small agreement. As a result of that first agreement, that the forest might occasionally give permission for wood to be gathered and occasionally trees to be cut, at times and quantities the forest would dictate, in exchange for certain offerings and observances, the god of the silent became stronger and more powerful, still at very little expense to itself, and the people living near the forest were safer and wealthier. Which, of course, led to more offerings and prayers, and, as the god realized just how much its power had increased, more agreements with the house of the silent, and by extension, the people of Iriden. The forest would protect the people of Iriden from stinging and biting insects, to a point, and only in exchange for regular offerings of blood. It also agreed to protect the people of Iriden from plagues and various contagious diseases. It allowed a road to cut across it, with the understanding that anyone who strayed off the road without the god's permission was at the forest's mercy. It tolerated the construction of a town, what would become Vastai, on the shore of the Shoulder Sea, and let wood be cut for its first buildings. But it only ever spoke to the mother of the Silent, and it was she who conveyed the god's wishes and requirements to the people of Iriden. And as the years went by, the people of Iriden were generous with grateful prayers and gifts, though they never lost their respectful fear of the forest. And the forest grew more and more powerful. The newly arrived followers of the Raven had no regard for such things. They went into the trees with axes and saws and the presumed protection of their own god, and did not come out. I imagine the Raven had thought the forest complacent. Perhaps he had tested its borders before this and gotten no very alarming response. And if you were to visit this land in those days, you might have thought it was a region of small to middling gods, each with their territory or speciality, each receiving a fair supply of offerings, but none of them particularly notable. And then the forest, an object of superstitious fear, certainly, but unless you already knew to the contrary, you might not suspect the extent and power of the god there. Then, as now, the god of the silent forest was worshipped in secret. Who knows why? Perhaps it's just that we gods, as you humans, have our own peculiar tastes and preferences. But whatever the reason, beyond the small public offerings at the edge of the forest or in front of the various houses of the silent, sacrifices to that god were and are largely made in secret, silence, and darkness. Perhaps a more cautious, canny newcomer would have thought twice before starting a war with a forest that all the surrounding peoples held in superstitious dread. But while the Raven can certainly be canny, I would say that he is cautious only where he is compelled to be. And having clearly offended what was very likely the most powerful god for hundreds of miles around, he did not retreat or respond with anything but the brashest aggression. With a word, he set fire to the trees. The people of Vastai and the surrounding area had not thought too much about new arrivals before this, either humans or gods. They lived by the sea, near an adequate if small harbour, and in sight of another, busier one. Travellers came and went all the time. Sometimes those travellers stayed. New people were generally welcomed, along with the goods they often bought, or the connections to faraway places that fed the trade that helped make both Vastai and Ardvustia good places to live. And what was one more god in the scheme of things? Ambitious gods were naturally attracted to places like Ardvustia and Vastai, and if those gods could provide the sort of favours that would earn them steady offerings, well, so much the better for everyone. So the inhabitants of that older Vastai had likely wasted little thought on the arrival of the Raven and his followers, and they had likely not troubled themselves when those followers went into the forest with their axes, beyond warning them not to do it. The god of the silent could take care of itself. As indeed it did. Whole trees uprooted themselves and walked into the sea. That same sea rushed roaring up onto the shore and into the trees. Rivers, large and small, broke their banks and washed over the trees, and where that water did not reach, the fires simply ceased to burn. And when all that fire was contained and extinguished, the trees that had doused themselves in the sea walked again to their places and sent their roots back down into the earth. These actions were, I am sure, more than just self-defence. They were a show of power. The Raven had presumed that he was stronger than the forest, that he could disregard it. The forest now showed the Raven his mistake. And the next morning, the remaining inhabitants of the Raven's house woke to find dozens of people sitting outside their gate, naked and smeared with ash. This might not seem strange to you. You are, after all, Iridenni, and so you know what a serious act this was, a public accusation designed to cast shame and disrepute on its target. But I must admit, it seems odd to me. No one in the far north would sit naked outside the door of someone who had wronged them and expect any result besides hypothermia. And no one, sitting shivering in front of someone's house, would be taken as a serious threat. But in Iridenn, as in the lands farther to the southwest, people in authority, kings, lords, wealthy landowners, will sometimes go to impressive lengths to appease complainants willing to do this in order to prevent damage to their reputation and standing. It is, if not a common sight, a well-known and effective way to shame someone who was dealt unjustly with another. And so, accordingly, the raven was shamed by this. Or so the story goes. I have my doubts. I suspect that the raven and the god of the silent had each made their own calculations. The forest's display of power in extinguishing the raven's flames would likely have left the raven finally aware of just how powerful the forest was, and he, no doubt, recognised that he had no way of knowing if the god of the silent had spent all or most of its power in this one spectacular display of it, or if there was far, far more the forest could do to threaten the raven. I am quite certain the raven now realised that he had gotten himself into a situation from which he might not be able to extricate himself with dignity. The god of the silent, for its part, had doused the fire and might or might not have been able to do so a second time. Were I in the place of the god of the silent, I might have wanted to end the argument as quickly and with as little further damage to myself as possible. Were I in the place of the god of the silent, I would have said to the raven, "I can outlast you." Whatever communications passed between the raven and the god of the silent, in the end, they came to an agreement. Even then, as you no doubt already know, the Tell pressed at the southern boundaries of Iridenn. So they agreed the raven would assist in the defence of those boundaries. The raven would also assist the silent forest in its existing commitments to the people of Iridenn. As part of this agreement, the raven, now the raven of Iridenn, would be due a periodic human sacrifice. That sacrifice would come from among the descendants of the raven's followers. I speak, of course, of the lease. In exchange for the lease's voluntary sacrifice, he would share authority over Iridenn with the Council of the Directions. And to be sure, that authority was indeed shared, and no doubt because the god of the silent, or at any rate its representative, was no fool, the mother of Vastai Silent must approve the appointment of any new lease, and she must have the right to speak to the lease for the god of the silent, and to speak to the raven of Iridenn directly. It may be that the forest thought it had made a good bargain. The directions were originally all native Iridenni, though these days intermarriage has made such distinctions almost entirely theoretical. But the council would owe its first loyalty to Iridenn and to the forest, while the mother of the silent could exercise very direct power over the bench. And in the meantime, Iridenn would benefit from the raven's power. He had, after all, dared to attack the forest and still lived, which suggested that the forest either dared not or could not retaliate by merely striking him dead. And the raven did not plan to sit secure in Vastai. He had ambitions. Ambitions that centred on the strait between Vastai and Ardvulkthia. By this time, Ardvulkthia was a thriving town. Ships and boats passed daily through the strait, from the shoulder sea into the wider ocean and back, bringing goods and people. Ardvustia was home to quite a few powerful gods, and even more who were less powerful, but who, for the most part, lived well, granting a steady flow of small favours in return for similarly small prayers and offerings. I dare say the gods of Ardvustia had found long ago that things were better for everyone when gods cooperated and when humans followed suit. There was no single god of Ardvustia, no one supreme power. Why would there need to be? But the raven did not, when he looked at the strait, see a bounty in which he might take a share. No, the raven looked at the strait and saw that all of its riches might be taken for himself. The Strait of Ardvustia is one of the very few navigable outlets to the ocean from the shoulder sea. Nearly every ship that wants to make that voyage must pass through that strait. And if you can control the strait, you can control that traffic and even take a cut of that trade all for yourself. I am sure the Raven of Iriden had settled in Vastai with precisely that aim in mind. I don't know how much work he had to do to convince the God of the Silent to assist him in that project, but assist him that God assuredly did. And according to the story I have heard, it began very simply. Once two or three leases had been paid, the raven simply stated that henceforth no ship or boat would safely traverse the strait without the approval of the Raven of Iriden. So simple for a god. Speak what one wishes to be true, and your power will make it so. But so many simple statements stand before a reality that is not simple at all. Only the most powerful gods may rely on stating their wishes so sweepingly. The insufficiently powerful and insufficiently wise run great risks in speaking this way. I think the raven knew this. I am given to understand that he made sure to obtain the assistance of not only the forest, but most of the other, smaller gods in Iriden, before he spoke. And I am sure he also appraised the combined strength of the gods of Ardvustia, and concluded that he could afford the fight that would surely come once he had spoken, and Ardvustia realized what he had done.